Well, this is Rothbard on taxation is the topic for tonight, as you all know. And the reading that I picked, the chapter from Power and Market on the Rothbardian analysis of taxation, contains a classic Rothbard quote about the nature of the state. And we've seen something similar to this when we talked about his essay on the nature of the state. But it's just so juicy and so vintage Rothbard, I think it's worth repeating some of this, where he compares government to a criminal gang. And by the way, the word praxeology means the science of human action, and that's what Austrian economics is all about. So when you read words like praxeologically, it means in terms of studying human action, human endeavors. And he says this: it should be understood that praxeologically, there is no difference between the nature and effects of taxation and inflation on the one hand, and of robberies and counterfeiting on the other. Both intervene coercively in the market to benefit one set of people at the expense of another set. But the government imposes its jurisdiction over a wide area and usually operates unmolested. Criminals, on the contrary, usually impose their jurisdiction on a narrow area only and generally eke out a precarious existence. Even this distinction does not always hold true, however. In many parts of many countries, bandit groups win the passive consent of the majority in a particular area and establish what amounts to effective governments or states within the area. The difference between a government and a criminal band, then, is a matter of degree rather than kind, and the two often shade into each other. So government is just a big criminal gang, according to Rothbard. This brings to mind a story of some of the precursors of the Austrian School of Economics were Spanish Jesuits and of the, I think, the 16th century, and Dominican priests. And the Mises Institute held a conference in Salamanca, Spain, a couple of years ago. And one of the stories that was told there, the true story, about one of these Spanish scholastics, as they were called, who sent the King of Spain, or was known for arguing to the King of Spain that what the King of Spain was doing in coin clipping was robbery. That is, the king would call in the coins, the money, and melt them down and extract some of the gold from them and then put, you know, lead or whatever in their place. And so you might have a coin that was 100% gold, and what you get back is 50% gold. It was called coin clipping. And this priest insisted that this was robbery. And for that, he was put in prison by the King of Spain. And the Pope himself at the time intervened by writing the King of Spain a letter saying, either refute the priest's contention that what you are doing by inflating the currency is robbery, or let him go. And the King of Spain let him go. He let him out of jail. And that illustration comes to mind when I read this Rothbard quote about government as just another criminal gang, in effect. And Rothbard also starts out by quoting Calhoun again. And so you can see by now, I think, why I put the disquisition on government in week two on the syllabus, because again and again, whenever Rothbard writes about taxing and spending, he comes back to the libertarian class theory as espoused by John C. Calhoun, among others. And then he starts out, he gets into the real economics of taxing and spending and what distinguishes Rothbard from other economists who study or who have written in the field of public finance, government finance, is that he's always very conscious to talk about the spending side of the budget as well as the tax side of the budget. A lot of this field, if anyone has ever taken a course or if you were to look up a textbook in public finance, it always dwells on the tax side while sort of giving short shrift to the expenditure side. But, of course, that's not legitimate. When the government taxes so that it can spend. So if you want to analyze the true effects of taxation, you also have to use economics to analyze the spending side of the budget, too. And so... And that's, of course, is exactly what Rothbard does. And a number of the points that he makes is that, you know, all government spending he considered to be a consumption expenditure, not an investment expenditure. No matter how many times politicians repeat the word investment, we're investing in our children, investing in the future, investing in the schools, and on and on and on. But that really is a misnomer, because after all, what is an investment? It's someone who personally sacrifices present consumption by using some of their savings to invest in a business or in the stock market or something. They take on a risk because they hope to earn a return for taking on the risk. And the return may come in the form of investing in the market, or may come in the form of starting a business, which is always risky, that turns out to be profitable so that you earn higher income in the future. You invest in yourself. When you educate yourself, it's called human capital investment. That's what investment is. But when government spends money, the politicians take no personal risk at all, and they're just spending to use tax dollars to win re-election. And they're spending on things that are determined by their own personal whims, because there is no way for consumers to register their true demands for government like we do in the market. We put down our dollars in the market every day, and we take them away also by switching products. We don't do that in government. We have elections, and the elections are pretty well rigged, as we've already discussed in the course. So all government expenditure should be considered to be a consumption expenditure by the politicians, not by you and me, not by the consumers, but by the politicians. It's their own private piggy bank, and that is the treasury. Another thing that taxation does that is insidious, according to Rothbard, is that it severs remuneration from production. In the market, when you work, when you run a business, you grow a business, you get paid if you're a success. So remuneration is connected to work, saving, investing, producing things. In government, it's not. In fact, it's quite the opposite. In government, government basically taxes the efficient working people and gives the money away to the leeches and parasites of the world while keeping a tidy portion for itself. I would agree with Rothbard. I would consider most federal bureaucrats to be leeches and parasites of first order. And so there's no connection at all between what you produce for your fellow man and what you get paid, as there is in the market. In the government, it's totally severed. He also makes a very good point on about the so-called income distribution by harping on the language of distribution. This implies to people that there's some sort of big pot of money out there, and that the main function of society is simply to decide how the pot of money is to be distributed. And of course, there's no connection there with that kind of thinking between working, saving, investing, risk-taking, and so forth, and earning money. It's just, let's give it away to whoever we want to give it away to, income distribution or redistribution. And it reminds me of what my old friend, the economist Walter Williams, often says in his speeches. He says dollars are, I think he calls them certificates of public performance, or certificates of performance, because in a market economy, if you have money in your pocket, it's proof that you have collaborated with someone to produce a good or service for which your fellow man will pay you. So you have money and certificate of performance. Whereas with government, with the whole system of taxing one group and giving the money away to a different group, there is no performance. You're just a beggar of one form or another if you've been begging or lobbying, to use a more polite word, or being politically active, to use a more polite word, in order to get your share of your neighbor's loot through taxation. Okay, and then of course a big point that Rothbard makes, he takes on a lot of conservatives here, is that the real important point with regard to the effects of taxation is the amount of the tax. The kind of tax is relatively trivial. So whether you call it the fair tax, the flat tax, consumption tax, or the banana tax, whatever, it doesn't really matter. What really matters is how many resources the state is extracting from the private sector to use for its own purposes as decided by the politicians. That's the important thing. So it doesn't really matter if you have a flat tax versus a progressive tax versus any other kind of tax, head tax. It's how much tax that is that should be focused on. And for example, I was at the Florida straw poll a couple of weekends ago, and Herman Cain made his last-minute pitch for votes among all the old and enfeebled neocons who dominated the audience and the votes at the there at the Florida straw poll. There were very few real citizens who actually voted. They imposed a poll tax of $175, probably to keep the Ron Paul people out. But anyway, Herman Cain makes a speech, and he wants a 9% flat tax, income tax, a 9% sales tax, and a 9%, I guess, unemployment insurance tax. And he claims that his system will be revenue neutral. And what that means is that in Washington speak is that the government will never, ever take in a penny less year over year. And so to be acceptable to the Washington establishment, you have to say the magic words, revenue neutral, whenever you talk about tax reform. Ron Paul does not do that, of course. When he ran for president last time in 2008, he advocated the complete abolition of the income tax and its replacement with nothing. And he was correct. I looked up the numbers. He said that if we did that then in the year 2008 and nothing changed, then the government, the federal government, would still take in the same amount of revenue it took in 1997 without any income tax revenue whatsoever. And the federal government was grotesquely overbloated and unconstitutional in 1997. But Herman Cain and all the rest don't play that game. They're not interested in cutting back on government. And so they use the magic words revenue neutrality, which Rothbard sort of pokes fun at also. But that's what they mean when they talk about revenue neutrality. Now, unlike all the businesses who lose money, unlike homeowners who lose their houses, unlike people who lose their jobs and have a temporary cut in income, never, ever, ever should government ever have a dime less in revenue year after year. That's what that language is used to support, that whole idea. And, of course, the most important part of what Rothbard talks about here is tax incidence, what we call tax incidence. That is, who ends up paying a tax? Who is supposed to pay the tax by the name of the tax is not always the same as who ends up paying. You have to understand a little bit of economics, a little bit of supply and demand, really, to understand who really ends up paying the tax. Because a lot of taxes have grandiose sounding names or confusing names, like the corporation income tax. Anybody who works for a corporation bears part of the burden of that tax, even though it's called the corporation income tax. It's not called the corporation and its employees income tax. But the employees share in the burden of that tax, and I'll explain why shortly. And so you can't just rely on the name of a tax. Well, if it's called a sales tax on Twinkies, economists can help you understand who ends up paying. And the main point that Rothbard makes here, which is very different from mainstream analysis of taxation, of tax incidence, is that no tax can be shifted forward. That is, no tax can be passed on from a business to its customers. Okay, not a sales tax, a gasoline tax, an alcohol tax, and so forth. What can happen, though, is that when a particular industry is taxed, for example, that tax will reduce the rate of return to investing in that industry. It will reduce the profitability of that industry. It may cause some of the what we call marginal firms, firms that are barely making a profit, to go out of business, and other firms will have to cut back on production because they won't have enough resources to produce as much as they used to because they're paying a tax. They're giving money, some of their resources, to the government. If that happens, then the supply of the good or service produced by that industry will diminish, it will decline, and that will drive up the price. So you can see a tax imposed on an industry and then prices going up. But it's not quite as simple as the business simply raising its price to pass on the tax to its customers and not pay any of the tax on its own. And Rothbard argues businesses strive to maximize revenues at all times, and so they're already charging as high a price as the market will bear. They don't need to be spurred on by government tax collectors or tax policymakers to raise their prices. They've already raised them as high as they can get away with. And so there's no such thing as passing on a tax forward to consumers from a business in the eyes of Rothbard. But who does pay the tax is that since the profitability of the enterprise is down, some of the money that would have been made as profit goes to the state, then the owners or investors in an industry pay part of the price by lower return on investment. The workers pay a price in the form of lower wages and fringe benefits because there's not as much money as there used to be to pay them. The input owners, that is all the suppliers of materials and things that go into the production of a product, they make less because there's a lower rate of return on what they're doing because that some of that money has gone on to the government. So all of the factors of production, so to speak, the landowners, the suppliers of inputs, the workers, they all pay in a tax such as a general sales tax. So what that means is that a general sales tax, which is sometimes called a consumption tax by conservatives, by supposedly free market conservatives, really is an income tax because it diminishes the income of all these people, the business owners, the workers, the input suppliers, the factory owners. Their income all goes down to some degree, so that a general sales tax would essentially be an income tax, and it's really no different. And so if you see some of the presidential candidates or whoever advocating a consumption tax, they really are spitting into the wind. Or maybe a better thing to say is they're rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, especially if they talk the language of revenue neutrality. And of course, the real danger is what the government would probably do is to pile a consumption tax such as a value-added tax or a national sales tax on top of the income tax and not replace the income tax. Or if they did eliminate the income tax and then adopt a consumption tax, they'll bring the income tax back. And so before too long, we'll have both. That's what is most likely to happen, I think. And so a general sales tax, if we had a general sales tax, it is shifted, but it is shifted backwards. And it's to the factor owners and the workers and the investors. It's not shifted forward to consumers. And this is because of one of the principles of Austrian economics, that cost does not determine price. Price is determined by demand, consumer demand, and the stock of supply of a product. It's not determined by cost. And so a sales tax, a general sales tax, does not penalize consumption in particular, but it does penalize consumption. You can't consume as much because you have less income, but it also penalizes savings and investment. You can't save as much and invest as much. Investors don't have as much to invest with. And so the fallacy that Rothbard points out here with so-called mainstream economists is that they think a consumption tax would punish consumption and therefore encourage more savings. And they say savings is a good thing because it fuels investment, which it does. But it doesn't work like that. A consumption tax is essentially or effectively an income tax, and it will reduce savings as well as consumption. So you're not going to spur savings at the expense of consumption with a consumption tax in the form of a national sales tax, as some people think. And besides that, there's sort of a fetish that some conservative economists have over savings. There's nothing especially meritorious about savings versus consumption. It's all a matter of personal choice. We all have different rates of time preference, which means we all have different rates at which we would consume now versus consume in the future. A man and wife with five children are motivated to save more for the future of their children than, say, a couple who is 65 years old. Their children are adults now with children of their own. They don't have as much of a future to save for, so they save less. They have a different rate of time preference. The second group would say we have a lower rate of time preference. And that's just a matter of personal choice. A high rate of time preference is not better or worse than a low rate of time preference. It's like saying some people like Coca-Cola and some people like Pepsi-Cola. Economics has nothing to say about that at all, whether or not high rates of time preference are superior to lower rates of time preference. Okay, so a consumption tax would essentially be an income tax, no difference. Now, on income taxation in general, Rothbard is pretty mainstream. He understands, of course, that any kind of income tax is a deterrent to work. If you reduce the rewards to working, you'll get less work. If you reduce the rewards to anything, you'll get less of anything, whatever it is, work, saving, investment, and so forth. And income taxation certainly does that, direct income taxation. And this, I suppose, was a major reason why the American Founding Fathers did not include income taxation in the United States Constitution. And of course, so our standard of living is diminished by income taxation. On the other hand, the power of the state is greatly expanded because with all that income, and it lays a claim on all of our income, the state is much more powerful than it otherwise would be. During the American Civil War, for example, the U.S. government had a terrible time enforcing military conscription. But after the income tax came in 1913, and it was so awash in money, it very easily enforced military conscription for World War I and World War II and other wars as well, because it had the funds from the income tax and from the Fed. It was also created in 1913. And so, you know, one argument that is sometimes made by economists is that they'll say, well, yes, income taxation can be a deterrent to work because it reduces the remuneration for work. There are the famous examples of back in 1980 when the top marginal tax rate was 70%. If you had, at that point in history, if you had, say, a man and wife who were both lawyers in their 30s and they each made $100,000 a year and had family income of $200,000, that would put them up in the 70% tax bracket. So once they reached that level of income, every $1,000 they earn, they would owe $700 in federal tax, just federal tax, not to mention state or local tax. And so they would just quit working quite often in October once they reached that plateau and go on vacation. And so high rates of income taxation would obviously be a deterrent to work. But some of the defenders of income taxation say, well, on the other hand, it is plausible that people will even work harder to maintain their standard of living. And so you get more work, more production out of them. And Rothbard responds to that by saying, oh, great, you're defending a system that makes me work like a slave for the same amount of money that I used to work just as a normal human being for. You know, that's sort of hardly, that's faint praise, I guess, is what he's saying. And so that's unnecessarily a meritorious thing, that you have to work twice as hard to tread water, economically speaking. Okay, now the income tax penalizes all consumption, present consumption and future consumption. So it's, you know, in terms of being revenue neutral, it's equally bad on your current standard of living and your future standard of living. And so Rothbard makes that very important point. And another point that Rothbard makes here that is very mainstream is that in keeping with his analysis that taxes are generally passed on backwards, they're not shifted forwards but backwards, is the Social Security tax and the unemployment insurance tax that are paid, or at least a portion of the Social Security tax that is paid directly to the government by employers. Of course, the average worker thinks that he or she is getting something for nothing there. The employer is paying it for me. But this gets shifted back to you, the employee, in the form of lower wages. If your employer has to send $5,000 a year to the government as his contribution, so-called, for Social Security, that's $5,000 less that you are making from the employer. And so that's how that tax is shifted back. And the same is true of unemployment insurance. Employees will be paid more without that. In a competitive marketplace, competition will tend to drive wages and compensation levels up to the level that economists call the value marginal product, which is the additional product produced by that worker when he or she is hired, priced at the market price. And so in a competitive market, wages or compensation levels, I should say, are pushed up to that level. And that compensation comes in various forms. It comes in wages and fringe benefits. And so when the government says, we are going to force an extra fringe benefit on an employer, what the employer will do is cut back on other fringe benefits, cut back or wages at the same time. So it is shifted backwards to the employee one way or another, whether it is unemployment insurance, Social Security taxes, or any other kind of government-mandated benefit. That's the cost side. Even the language here is very skewed. It's always called mandated benefits, but of course you cannot mandate a benefit without also mandating a cost, because there's no such thing as a free lunch. Someone has to pay for that benefit. And so that's another important point that the Rothbard makes here about the backward shifting of taxes. And now the corporation income tax is a little tricky to understand who pays the corporation income tax, because first of all, there's double taxation. The corporation pays this corporation income tax, and then what's left may be paid back to the shareholders as dividends, dividend income, and then they pay income tax on the dividend income. And so there's double taxation of corporate income. But the standard analysis is very close to what Rothbard says about who ends up paying the corporation income tax, because here's what happens. When the government wages a tax on corporate income, it reduces the rate of return to investing in all American corporations. We're talking about the U.S. corporation income tax. So if the average rate of return were, say, 10%, you buy stock at IBM or Microsoft or whoever, and you know, for every $1,000 invested, you earn $100 a year. That's a 10% return. Then the government comes around and puts a tax on corporation income, so you only earn, say, 5% return. So you only make $50 for every $1,000 that you invest. Well, right off the bat, all investors in corporation income or corporations make less money. And since corporations, there's less investment that's going to be made as a result. It's less profitable. Investment income will switch from to some degree from corporate to non-corporate uses, such as agriculture, state and local government, housing, and so forth. So there'll be more investment there. And because of the law of diminishing returns, since there's more investment in these other areas, the rate of return there will also fall. It's the law of diminishing returns. And so as a result of the corporation income tax, there's a lower rate of return on investing in corporations, and there is also a lower rate of return on investing anywhere else in the economy. So all business investment of any kind, corporate or non-corporate, has a lower rate of return. And what that means is that all the factory owners and the workers make less money in everywhere. It is impoverishing. And so once again, it is a transfer of resources from the private sector, and you can trace through all the workers, the input suppliers, factory owners, and so forth. They're all worse off. They're all poorer. But the state is richer, the bureaucrats are richer, the politicians are richer, and the various interest groups that they pander to get reelected are richer. They have more money also. And so once again, it's always the same. The government imposes any kind of tax. It causes unemployment of resources, including labor resources, in those areas that are taxed, the private sector, while bloating the government sector. There'll be more people working there, more money spent there, more materials used there, and so forth, at the expense of a diminished private sector, whether it's corporate taxation, income taxation, sales taxation. It differs somewhat depending on the nature of the tax, but in general, it's the total amount of the tax that is important, as Rothbard says, not the type of tax. That's relatively minor as far as this is concerned. Okay. So that's sort of an overview of some of the main points, I think, of taxation, the economics of taxation in the eyes of the Austrian school in general, and Murray Rothbard in particular. And I'd like to try to illustrate something here. These principles by talking about tax loopholes, tax deductions. And the language never changes. The language of tax deductions, tax loopholes, never seems to change at all. I have in front of me a quotation from a 2004 Associated Press story about something the Bush administration was proposing at the time. And you hear the same words from the Clinton administration, the Obama administration. They say the exact same thing all the time whenever they talk about tax reform. And here's the AP Associated Press report said that the administration wants to simplify the nation's tax laws by eliminating tax deductions, but such proposals are often thwarted by Washington lobbyists determined to protect special tax breaks for their clients. Okay, and President Bush said he wanted a tax that was, quote, fair without tax loopholes for special interests. And it was also revenue neutral. There's that magic phrase, revenue neutral. The AP also quotes various Republican politicians in the House of Representatives as saying that they favored, quote, a flat tax that gets rid of deductions, while other conservative tax reformers argue for reduced income tax rates that are paid for by eliminating or scaling back tax deductions. So there's that revenue neutral language in disguise again, paid for. That means the government can never, ever, ever take in a penny less year over year. Any reduction in any one tax has to be paid for by an increase in another tax. And of course, eliminating a tax deduction is a tax increase. That's why, in fact, all during the talk several months ago about the phasing out of the Bush tax cuts, that was not about cutting anybody's tax. That was about raising taxes by allowing an old tax cut law to go out of existence, which would have raised taxes of a lot of people. And so this type of language was pointed out in the essence of it was pointed out by another one of Rothbard's favorite authors, in addition to Calhoun, and this was Frank Chodorov, who I think I've mentioned before in this course. And that's spelled Chodorov, Frank Chodorov. And he wrote a classic book called The Income Tax, Root of All Evil, which it might be online. I know it's for sale on Mises.org, but it might be online. And so here's what Chodorov said about this, is that when we adopted the income tax, the government is essentially saying this: your earnings are not exclusively your own. We, the government, have a claim on them, and our claim precedes yours. We will allow you to keep some of it because we recognize your need but not your right. But whatever we grant you for yourself is for us to decide. Moreover, the amount of your earnings that you may retain for yourself is determined by the needs of government, and you have nothing to say about it. And that is certainly true, isn't it? That the government, by setting the tax rate, it implicitly assumes that it owns all of your income. You are a slave, and it will decide how much of your income you get to keep by determining, first and foremost, its needs, government's needs. That's why we have all the language of revenue neutrality, paying for tax cuts, and so forth. Under no situation shall government ever, ever take in a penny less, okay, no matter what, no matter how poor the population is. Chodorov goes on to say this about when the income tax amendment was passed in 1913. He said, quote, the absolute right of property in the United States was violated. That, of course, is the essence of socialism. Whatever else socialism is, Its first tenet is the denial of private property. All socialists, beginning with Karl Marx, have advocated income taxation, and the heavier the better. And he's exactly right about that. A lot of academic economists who call themselves free market economists, call themselves conservatives, have given support for socialistic tax policies. And there are all kinds of arguments in favor. One of the favorite arguments is that if we have tax deductions and loopholes, then taxpayers are induced to spend a lot of time trying to evade taxes, either legally or illegally. Tax evasion or tax avoidance is what they do. And the argument goes that, well, all the time that was spent trying to avoid taxes could have been spent at work, working instead of hiring, and the money you spend hiring tax accountants and lawyers could have been spent elsewhere. Therefore, the economy is less efficient as a result. And so they call this deadweight loss, all this effort of trying to, paying people to prepare your 50-page tax return and things like that is lost effort. It's inefficient. Okay, Rothbard doesn't buy that, though. He doesn't buy that it's necessarily bad. And because he says this, he says that the underlying premise behind this line of argument is that the government has taken too little of your income, and that simplifying the tax code and means the government is going to take more of your income, and that is somehow efficient. But as Rothbard always argued, individuals always spend their own money more efficiently than politicians do. Politicians, in spending someone else's money, are always much sloppier and inefficient in how they spend it. So in the name of efficiency, some economists make the case that more money should be extracted from the private sector, from the pockets of the taxpayers, and handed over to politicians and bureaucrats to fund more wars in Libya and a bigger welfare state and on and on and on. And that's called efficiency. And another thing that I always liked about Rothbard here is that he pulled the mask off of the economists who make these arguments under the guise of science and claiming to be objective scientists and making these arguments when they're not. They're really arguing for another attack on private property, which of course your income is, whenever they argue for eliminating loopholes. Okay. And so you could think of tax accountants as heroes. Adam Smith, the famous Adam Smith, author of The Wealth of Nations, he considered smugglers to be heroes because what were they doing? They were smuggling, helping people smuggle food in and other items into the United States that was being kept out by protectionist tariff laws. And so the smugglers were actually helping the citizens. And so if tax accountants and lawyers are helping citizens keep more of their money, and keep the money out of the claws of the state, they're doing heroic work in the eyes of Murray Rothbard. He wrote an essay once that Rothbard did called The Myth of Tax Reform. It's in his book, The Logic of Action 2, on page 119, where he said this: every activity that escapes taxes and controls is not only a blow for freedom and property rights, is also one more instance of a free flow of productive energy getting out from under parasitic repression. That is why we should welcome every new loophole, shelter, tax credit, or exemption, and work not to shut them down, but to expand them to include everyone else. And this leads to another criticism that mainstream so-called free market economists make sometimes, is that, well, sometimes when government grants deductions, tax deductions or loopholes, so-called, to some industries but not all, it causes a misallocation of resources and that there be more investment in those industries that are less heavily taxed at the expense of less investment somewhere else. So there will be a different configuration of investment than would exist in a free market with no differential tax policy. Well, that's true. That's true. That will happen. But the mainstream economists will say, therefore, we should eliminate the tax deductions. Once again, Rothbard gets to the heart of the issue here, and he says, wait a minute, consider the expenditure side of the budget also. What you're really saying is that, like, once again, that we should take more money out of the pockets of the people and give it to politicians and bureaucrats to spend, and you want to call that efficient. He makes the argument that if tax deductions are selective and don't apply to all industry, then the proper approach in the name of efficiency would be to expand them to the tax deductions to more industries, not to eliminate the deductions that a few industries benefit from now, but to expand them so that everyone can enjoy them. Just the opposite of the standard argument. And once again, he points out the hypocrisy of the mainstream economists who claim to be objective in not making value judgments when they say these things, but they are. Okay, let's see what else I can say about Rothbard here. Another quote from Rothbard in that same essay, where he said, says, what is the alternative? If investment, energy, or other tax credits or deductions are abolished, resources will not automatically go into more productive areas. Instead, they go into government via higher taxes and will simply be wasted, thrown down the rat hole of unproductive and profligate government spending. That's Rothbard. And so von Mises himself said something very similar to this. And this is on the Mises blog, Mises on Tax Deductions. He said this at a 1952 conference in which there was a discussion, once again, mainstream economists complaining about too many tax loopholes. Here's what von Mises said. He said, quote, let us be grateful for the fact that there are still such things as those the honorable gentleman, he's referring to one of the people in attendance, calls loopholes. Thanks to these loopholes, this country, the United States, is still a free country, and its workers are not yet reduced to the status and distress of their Russian colleagues. And so that was Mises on loopholes. He was a real Rothbardian, so to speak, on the whole issue of loopholes. And the final thing I'll mention about taxes here, in the context of all the tax reform that's perpetually discussed in Washington, D.C., and especially now that we have a presidential election coming up and we have all these candidates, is keep in mind what happened when the income tax came in. A major political force in favor of an income tax in the late 19th and early 20th century was farmers, because farmers were grossly discriminated against in the tax system of that day, which relied mostly on protectionist tariffs. And so farmers found that protectionist tariffs that kept mostly European merchants from making money, it impoverished them by not allowing them to make money here in this country, in the United States. And as a result, they had fewer dollars with which to purchase American goods, which were primarily farm goods. So farmers understood that the high tariffs on imports were discriminatory against them. So therefore, the government promised them, they said, if you support politically an income tax, we will reduce the tariff rate, which they did. And so farmers were very potent politically in the late 19th, early 20th century, much more than today. And so they did. They supported the income tax, and the tariff rate was reduced from around 45% down to around 15 to 20% on average, and the farmers were happy for a short time. Okay, then the income tax came in. The top rate was 5%. Within 7 years, the top income tax rate was 70%. It went from actually 7%, not 5, to 7%, to 70%. And then the tariff rate, in 1922, 9 years after the income tax came in, the Fordney-McCumber tariff, that's spelled Fordney-McCumber, M-C-C-U-M-B-E-R, named after two members of Congress, tariff, increased the average tariff rate back up to about 33%. And then by 1929, not too many years after the income tax came in, the average tariff rate was increased to almost 60%, 59.1% with the Smoot-Hawley tariff of 1929, which could be called the Smoot-Hawley-Hoover tariff. And so this was a giant bait-and-switch game where people were told, oh, the income tax will only apply to the super rich, and the top rate even for them is 7%. But within 7 years, it was 70%. And it went down after World War I, but it never went back down to 7% again. And so whenever you talk about tax reform today, in the form of, say, Herman Cain wanting a 9% tax on income, a 9% sales tax, well, that'll soon become 19%, 29%, 39%. There's nothing to stop it. Congress will do it, you know, whether it's run by Republicans or Democrats. And so, you know, the focus should be on the amount of the tax primarily, as Rothbard says, and not the kind of tax so much. And I think that's about all I was planning on saying for tonight in terms of my overview of Rothbardian tax policy or tax economics. And so we'll do the usual. I'll flip through our questions here, if we have some, and see what people are talking about. Or questioning me about. Let's see, who's Roger is worried about one industry using its clout to lobby for a tax exemption. Well, that benefits the consumers and the workers and the investors in that industry. Rothbard's analysis is that it should be expanded to other industries, not you shouldn't harm all the consumers and workers who are lucky enough, and investors who are lucky enough to benefit from lower taxes. And also keep your eye on the expenditure side. Government will get that money and grow the welfare warfare state. So if you're fine with that, and if you're so consumed by envy that you just can't stand living in a world where one industry has lower taxes than the others, then go ahead and favor that. Economic analysis doesn't tell you what you should do. It helps you understand what happens when this sort of thing occurs. And so if you're the sort that is so envious that you can't stand it, that somebody has lower taxes than you, then go ahead and advocate a bigger welfare state and a bigger warfare state, because that's what will happen if we get rid of the tax deduction. The government will expand itself and pay itself more money. John wants to know, where do I find the myth of taxation? I would guess Mises.org. Just type it in. You'll probably find it. Let's see, Hoppe correlated a high time preference to capital consumption. Rothbard wouldn't agree. Well, yeah, he would agree. He just says it's not necessarily good or bad. It's just an observation. Economic analysis tells you, can help you understand what is, what happens, but it doesn't say anything about whether or not it is good or bad. Individuals can, but not economic analysis. John is a little confused on the law of diminishing returns. Well, in general, when an investment takes place, I'll tell you a simple example of diminishing returns of a farmer adding more and more fertilizer, chemical fertilizer, to his corn crop. The first ton might increase his corn crop by 1,000 bushels, and the second ton of fertilizer also increases the corn crop, but by only 500 bushels. A third ton of fertilizer is added, and he gets another 100 bushels. So the product is increasing, but at a decreasing rate. That's called the law of diminishing returns. And it affects everything. It affects investments, investment in yourself, investment in corporations, and everywhere. So the more investment that takes place, and one way of thinking of it is an airline, for example. For the first $10 million, they might invest in an airplane, which would be very, very productive because they'll be able to fly people around in the airplane and make a lot of money doing that. But then the second $1 million, they might have to spend on repairs for their airplane. The third $1 million, they might have to spend on leasing out runway space. And all these things would increase revenue to the airline, but not by as much as the initial purchase of an airplane did. And so and it's all corporate investment. But as we make more and more corporate investment, not all investment projects are equally profitable. Corporations will go to the next best and the next best, the next best use of the funds at their disposal, which may all be profitable, but not as profitable as the previous investment. And so that's diminishing returns. Let's see. Eric wants to know if he's an envious guy, if he prefers the government to tax the rest of you at $100 and him zero. Yeah, I guess so. Let's see. More questions from anyone? I see a conversation about bank fees, which is that are going up, which is really sort of a indirect tax. Really, the culprit here is the Dodd-Frank bill, which imposed extremely heavy regulatory costs on banks. Government regulation is an implicit tax because it drives up the cost of being in the business that is increasingly regulated. And so banks are doing this in an attempt to deal with the Dodd-Frank regulation bill that was passed into law last year. John Turbidy wants to know about the paradox of savings. It's also called the paradox of thrift. It's an element of Keynesian economics that says if you save more money now, you will consume less. If you consume less, that's less spending that takes place in the economy, less aggregate demand in the language of Keynesian economics. And as a result of that, there will be a lower level of GDP, gross domestic product, because there's less consumer spending in the economy. If there's less production, less GDP, then there will be less income. People will make less money from less production. And if income goes down, savings goes down. Therefore, by saving more, you end up saving less. What this does is ignore the real world. It ignores the fact that savings fuels investment. Investment spending increases the rate of production, and when the rate of production goes up, it creates more wealth and more income, not less wealth and less income. And by creating more wealth and more income, we have more savings and more consumption in the future. So it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the whole function of savings and investment, because it is expressed in the form of a stylized make-believe theory that popped out of John Maynard Keynes' head and has really no real attachment to economic reality. And so that's why the paradox of savings is bogus, and was proven bogus, as was all of, by the way, all of Keynesian economics was abandoned by the academic economics profession in the 1970s with the advent of stagflation. It's only the hucksters and con artists like Paul Krugman who have been attempting to resuscitate it. And, of course, politicians always love it because it's a rationale for wild spending binges. You know, they've had their way. They've borrowed $5 trillion. No Keynesian has ever dreamed that the government would ever borrow $5 trillion in 3 years and spend it domestically, not on a war. But that's what they've done. And they have their court historians like Paul Krugman to back them up on it. And it sort of proves the point once again that during wartime, people become downright stupid and will pretty much believe almost anything the government tells them, at least the masses of the people do, because they go along with this. Now, let me see, what other question might we have? Chris wants to know how the estate tax came about. How the estate tax, I think it came about during the era of sort of another explosion of socialistic thinking, probably in the 30s, where it was said to be unfair for people to inherit wealth and create income inequality. And so we have the estate tax. And of course, government will always latch on to any excuse to tax us for anything. But of course, one of the side effects of the estate tax is people will invest less in their estates and their farms and their businesses if they think the government is going to confiscate it or a large portion of it at some point. And so it has a negative effect on production as far as that goes. Do you think taxes or the Fed inflation are more distorting? Economics can't say that. It depends on how much inflation and how much tax. There's no rule of thumb about that. Well, some of the differences, though, of course, the inflation tax is hidden, and it creates price inflation, and it creates boom and bust in the economy, whereas taxes are sometimes more direct. The income tax certainly is more direct than the inflation tax, but that's the main difference. Let's see, Eric still wants me to go along with tax fairness. None of it raises anyone's taxes. I'm opposed to raising anyone's taxes at any time for any reason because of the expenditure side of the budget. It'll grow the welfare warfare state, which makes us all worse off no matter what rate of tax we're paying. Roger wants to know, how would the carbon credit trading system used in Europe be viewed? Well, it's not a market, it's a contrived market, and it's run by government. They used to call it, 75 years ago, this was called market socialism, where governments would play at market. But of course, if it's not spontaneous, if it's not driven by supply and demand, consumers and producers in the marketplace, it's not a market. And so so the outcome of it all depends on how the system is set up by politicians and bureaucrats. It might seem on the outside very similar to markets, and I'm not familiar with exactly how they do it in Europe, but all of these trading systems are set up by governments. That's what led to the Enron scandal of a few years ago. This was all a rigged government scheme for trading energy. It wasn't a genuine market. Comments on school funding based on the property tax. Well, the property tax reduces the capital value of all property in a city, for one thing. So that's part of the tax. Part of the tax is not just the amount that you pay, the bill that you pay. The value of all houses, all buildings, all corporate headquarters all go down with property taxes, for one thing. It's also probably one of the most unfair taxes, if not the most unfair, because people without children or people whose children are no longer in school still have to pay the property tax for the benefit primarily of the government schools. And of course, in most places in the U.S., the government schools are a disaster. In the cities, even in the suburbs where the schools aren't so bad, they spend orders of magnitude more money to provide the same education that a lot of private schools do, even if they are pretty decent public schools in more affluent areas. And so it helps fund, it's the main funding source of a monopoly in what is arguably the most important industry, education, of primary and secondary education. So in that regard, Rothbard would regard it as totally an evil instrument of the state, that it funds a government-run monopoly of education, which has turned into largely mind control and propagandizing of children to be good little sheep who will follow whatever the state wants them to do. And so, Rothbard would not hesitate to put it that way if he were around, I think. Yeah, I care about tax fairness. It's not really fairness. It's sort of a government contrived ripoff of one group of people for the benefit of another group of people, primarily teachers' unions. Those are the main beneficiaries, of course, of the government's school monopoly, is the members of the teachers' unions, especially the worst teachers. The good teachers can find jobs elsewhere. They can find jobs out of teaching because they're competent people. It's the losers who are really the big beneficiaries, because they make far more money than they could make on an open free market as a teacher, if they could even qualify as a teacher on a free market. And so they're the biggest winners, and especially the educational bureaucrats, the administrators who make $200,000 or $300,000 a year plus benefits for administering disastrous school districts like Baltimore and Washington, D.C., where the graduation rate is something like 4% of the kids graduate. I think in Baltimore, the number of children reading at grade level is something like 2 or 3%, something like that. But the administrator makes over $300,000 a year plus benefits. So those are the main beneficiaries of the property tax. Let's see. Any other questions about taxation? Roger wants to know, was there ever a time in history of man when a person was protected from a theft by a judge or a court? Well, it's always a matter of degree. Even up to the American Civil War, the federal government only taxed the average citizen on the equivalent of about $45 a year. And the only contact the average citizen had with the federal government at that time was with the post office. And so there were taxes, and then of course the original U.S. Constitution outlawed taxes on income. That's why the first income tax came during the Civil War, was instituted by the Lincoln administration, and it was phased out in 1877. But the forces of statism got a taste during the war and for the several years after the war. And so they waged a multi-decade crusade to bring it back, and they eventually won by 1913 and got the income tax. But the United States went for all that period without an income tax, and relied mostly on tariffs and excise taxes on the selected items. But taxation has always been an act of theft. Yeah, Erwin Schiff, Peter Schiff's father, he's spent his life writing books about why you don't need to pay the income tax, supposedly, and then going to jail for it, and then apparently writing another book while in jail on the same topic, and then he gets out, he doesn't pay his income tax, goes to jail again. I wouldn't recommend that. Bob wants to know if I could discuss the codfish and armament example Rothbard uses. Well, sure, that's an example of, say there's a special tax on the codfish industry, and the money is gained to use to finance armaments. Well, what's going to happen is there'll be less money made in the cod fishing business. That means all the fishermen will make less money, and everyone who supplies them with nets and hooks and boats and things will make less money, because they'll have less money to spend on those things. So there'll be money taken out of the pockets of the cod fishermen and all of their suppliers, and all of that money goes into the treasury, the government treasury, which the politicians can then spend on whatever they want to spend it on. If they spend it on armaments, in Rothbard's example, that means some segment of the armaments industry will be enriched, and all the suppliers of armaments that get in on this will benefit. Through a sort of a multiplier process. They'll spend the money over and over again on different things. And so the transfer, once again, from the private sector to the government sector. That's why so-called stimulus spending never, ever has worked in the history of mankind, because it's simply robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's simply taking money out of the pockets of one group of people, taxpayers, who would have spent much of that money, who would have saved it, some of it, providing funds for investment in businesses and homes and other things, and allowing politicians to spend it. So you get bigger government, but a smaller private sector and higher unemployment in the private sector, always and everywhere, from so-called stimulus spending. That's what you get. And Rothbard's example is just one example of that. I don't know if it's possible to go back to gold standard. David Gramer is asking, yes, it certainly is good to back money by gold, money with gold. But under the gold standard, what happened was, the first bankers were goldsmiths. They had the equipment, they had the storage facilities, and people, they would store gold for people, and people would give them gold, and they would hand over a certificate saying, you can come and get your gold. I will warehouse it for you because I have a warehouse. I have a vault where I keep my gold. Okay, and that's where the first deposits came, money. That was the origin of paper money. There were these certificates where you could redeem your money in gold. And then some smart people got the idea of starting up banks. Because you're not letting the goldsmith have a monopoly on banking. And so what the banks started doing is lending money, of course. And what fractional reserve banking was about is issuing currency, paper currency, in excess of the amount of gold that you had. Under the gold standard, though, what the gold standard does is that if you inflate your currency, that is, if you issued more currency, say $1 million worth of currency, but you only had $100,000 worth of gold, people would catch on that there's something wrong here, that you don't have enough gold, especially once you run out. Once $100,000 has been taken back from you by your customers, and then the next customer comes in and you say, sorry, no gold, I can't give you, there'll be a run on the bank and you'll go bankrupt. And so the threat of bankruptcy disciplined banks from inflating the currency and creating price inflation. And that was the system that the world adopted for several thousand years. The whole business of government taking over the banking system and the monetary system is relatively new in human history. But that's essentially the virtue of the gold standard. And sure, we could get back here to it, but I can't predict. Bob wants examples of factors. What? The fishing example, the producer is the boat owner, and he purchases nets from the people who produce nets. A factor owner would be the guy who manufactures fishing nets. That'd be one example. Prior to the income tax in the United States, it was the federal government was mostly financed by tariffs and just a few selected excise taxes. Property tax, I think, came much later. There was a national property tax in the late 1700s that Alexander Hamilton was instrumental in putting in place, but it created a tax rebellion in New England, and it was dropped by the Jefferson administration. Let's see, John wants to know if I support government development agencies giving certain businesses property tax credits. Tax credits are generally a good thing. I'm in favor of any tax cut at any time to anybody for any reason. So I think tax credits, that's why you hear people like Ron Paul arguing for tax credits but not vouchers. A voucher is an expenditure of tax funds, but a tax credit is something that would deprive the state of money. And I'm out in the open. I believe that the state should be deprived of money, so I'm in favor of any kind of tax credit of any kind for any purpose. Because I agree with Rothbard that we need to take a look at the expenditure side of the budget always when we talk about taxation. Eric wants to know if the fishing boat can be converted to a gunboat. Well, sure it can. If you put a gun on a fishing boat, you've got a gunboat. And I guess that has always happened. Any more questions from the people? We've got about 8:40 here on my clock. Well, we seem to be running out of gas early tonight, which is okay. You don't have to be have a full tank every night. And I just hope that I was able to give you the essence of what Rothbard has had to say about taxation and his take on the economics of taxation and how it's different from some of the mainstream. And thanks a lot for participating. I hope you had a good class. I'll see you next week. And we'll learn a little more about Rothbardian economics. And take care.